Hi there. I'm so excited to welcome you to the Arthritis Life podcast, where we share arthritis life stories and tips for thriving with autoimmune arthritis. My name is Cheryl Crow, and I am passionate about helping people navigate real life with arthritis beyond joint pain. I've been living with rheumatoid arthritis for 20 years, and I'm also a mom, occupational therapist, video creator, support group leader, and I created the Room to Thrive self-management program. I am so excited to help you live a more empowered life with arthritis. We're going to cover everything from kitchen life hacks to navigating the healthcare system to coping with friends who just don't get it. Seriously, no topic is going to be off limits on this podcast. My interviewees and I share our honest stories of how chronic illness affects our lives. This includes discussions about mental health, sex, shame, pregnancy, body image, advocacy, self-acceptance, and so much more. You'll hear stories from all ends of the spectrum, from a person who's living in Medicaid remission from psoriatic arthritis to somebody living with severe mobility restrictions and severe pain from rheumatoid arthritis. You'll hear how people manage their conditions in different ways, like medications, mindfulness, movement, social support, work accommodations, and so much more. You'll also hear from rheumatology experts who just get it. We'll dive deep into the science behind chronic pain and what's the latest evidence for lifestyle changes that can help you thrive with arthritis, including exercise, sleep, nutrition, stress reduction, and more. This is your chance to sit down and chat with a friend who's been there. Ready to figure out how to manage your arthritis life? Let's get started. All right. I'm so excited today to have Rebecca Beasley from Juvenile Arthritis Research all the way from the UK. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you. I wish we were in person, but Zoom is the next best. So can you tell me real quick, I already gave away where you live, and where do you live and what is your relationship to arthritis?
So I live in the UK. In the part of the UK that I'm in is in Kent, so it's not too far from London. And I had my own condition is the fact I've had juvenile idiopathic arthritis since the age of 10. And I also have a daughter with the condition, and she's had it since the age of 2, and she's now 11. And we also run a charity, myself and my husband, called Juvenile Arthritis Research, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later on.
Oh, I didn't know you went with your husband too. That's awesome. It's a family affair. Yeah. And so I'm curious. Yeah. You said you were diagnosed when you were 10. Can you share a little more about your diagnosis journey? Like, what were your first symptoms and what was that like?
So I was a very, very sporty kid. So I loved netball, I loved hockey, long jump. And I first noticed I was getting pain in my hip. It was usually during sports. So I remember the first time I remember it very specifically was during a netball game. And after the netball, I could barely walk because my hip was just so sore. And it felt like almost like a twisting pain. I couldn't describe it other than it felt like a twisting sensation in my hip. And I just noticed it started to happen more and more frequently until eventually it got to the point the pain was so bad. One day I was sat down in assembly at school and I couldn't get up off the floor. And I got rushed to hospital that day, ended up staying in hospital. But the doctors at the time couldn't see anything obvious wrong. It was an orthopedic doctor. They did x-rays and they said, "We can't see anything wrong. We think she's putting it on and pretending that she's in pain to get out of going to school." And as a 10-year-old who loved school, that was devastating to hear. And my mum, bless her, she kept going back to the doctors at various points and saying, "You know, there's something wrong with my child. I want to know what's wrong." And I just don't feel she was taken seriously. So it was a long, long road to diagnosis. It took about a year before I eventually got my, you know, official diagnosis and a couple of hospital stays. So the second time I was in hospital for over a month. Wow. Before I finally got that diagnosis. So yeah, quite a long journey.
Wow. And I mean, it's no surprise I didn't see anything on the x-ray, because in case people don't know, an x-ray only shows like typically really bad damage that's gone all the way to the bone. Like nowadays they do more like diagnostic ultrasound and other more sensitive measures. But I'm so sorry you went through that. There's nothing worse than that feeling of being not believed, you know, by medical professionals. And accusing you of wanting to get out of school when you had no history of that and you loved school. I'm so sorry. That's just awful. Ugh. At least I'm glad that your parents were such good advocates for you. So you were in the hospital for a whole month before your diagnosis. What were they trying to figure out if it was lupus or something else? Or
exactly, because back in those days, as the case is still now, a diagnosis of JEA is by process of elimination. So they had to rule out TB, they had to rule out all sorts of other conditions, and there was no specialism such as pediatric rheumatology. So I did happen to see an adult rheumatologist at the time early on, and he kind of gave me a quick check over and said, no, this isn't arthritis. And eventually, having tested for everything else, they ended up concluding it was arthritis. I actually had to have an operation, like a hip biopsy, where they cut into, I've got quite a long scar on my hip, where they had to test for other things, you know, had to take bone samples and test for everything else as well. So in many ways, things have improved, that with pediatric rheumatology now, they can do a thorough examination of a child's joints and be able to say, yes, this, you know, this is JEA. So that's a really good thing that nowadays we have that didn't happen back then.
Yeah. And did you have the systemic symptoms like fever or fatigue, any of that? Okay.
Not for me. No, for me, it was mainly my left hip that was affected. So It was oligoarthritis just in my left hip mainly.
Okay. Wow. And what was your and your family's response to the diagnosis? Were you like relieved or were you scared or a mix of everything?
So I think this is where children are kind of more resilient than adults in many ways, because as a child going through it, I don't remember being particularly worried in the way that when my daughter started showing symptoms, there was a big worry as a parent. I was thinking, I want to know what's wrong with her, and all sorts of things go through your mind, because I think as an adult, you're aware of so many more things, so many more conditions that something could be, and that worry is just there. But for myself as a child, I don't remember being particularly worried about my future or what it could be. I just knew that something was wrong and I kind of wanted it just to get better, and I always assumed it would get better. I did have moments where I did feel quite emotional, and one of those times that I remember very specifically was the day of the actual diagnosis, and the doctor that kind of delivered that news. It was told in such a flippant way that I felt he didn't really understand that to a child to be told, you know, you've got this long-term condition. And I remember him saying, oh, she's going to have quite severe symptoms for around at least 2 years. And then he just carried on talking. And to a child, 2 years is forever. And I don't think he really appreciated that. So that was the first time that I actually thought, oh my goodness, 2 whole years before I'm going to see any kind of improvement. And that I felt quite emotional over that, because I'd kind of assumed once they find out what's wrong, they'll make me better and it'll all be okay. I also remember another time where I felt particularly emotional was after my long stay in hospital and going home and seeing my bedroom for the first time in over a month. And I just remember I looked at the ceiling, and compared to the hospital ceilings, it was this old building, the hospital, big wards and really high ceilings, and going home and just seeing my little low ceiling, I just burst out crying, and I couldn't really explain why, but I think it was all that emotion and everything I'd been holding in from what I'd been through. It all just came out that evening, seeing my ceiling at home.
Oh my gosh. I relate to so much of what you're saying in terms of, I think most kids and people who have adults who have no experience with chronic illness, if you have pain in one area of your body, you kind of assume it's an injury, or maybe it's, yeah, the bone isn't growing correctly or something, and that they'll be able to, the doctors will go fix it. Yeah. And then you find out that they're not going to be able to fix it. It's something you're going to have the rest of your life. That's a very daunting prospect. And I think your example of the doctor saying, you know, 2 more years, that seems like so long as a 10-year-old. That makes sense. It's 20% of your life is 2 years, right? So that's really tough. At the same time, like you're saying, on the other hand, you're just kind of like, okay, we'll just deal with this, because you don't really know. We don't really have perspective as a kid. Do you mind sharing, before we're going to get into more like understanding what happens when you grow up and you become an adult who has had juvenile idiopathic arthritis? There's a lot of kind of misconceptions out there. But first, can you share a little bit about your treatments that you've tried over the years, like what's helped and what's currently going well with your treatments?
Yeah. So in my situation, and I think a lot of people who hear this are quite shocked to hear it, I have never been on any DMARDs, so no methotrexate, no biologics. And part of the reason for that is when I was first diagnosed, it was in the 1980s, and those treatments weren't available. And the only pain relief options I had were paracetamol and ibuprofen, which did nothing to actually modify the disease. So my joint became very deformed and damaged very quickly. So within that, I think by the time they did give my diagnosis, it was showing on x-rays as being damaged, my hip joint. So after going through that and being several years on crutches, not being able to walk properly, I kind of got to the point where every time I was just going for my checkups, they were saying, well, there's nothing more we can do for you. And so I almost fell out of the medical system at the age of probably about 15, because I was told there's nothing more we can do. And I think we'll go on to talk about this, about the, you know, the difference between JAA and other types of arthritis. I suppose I never had reason to believe anything was different if I was to go back. So I then didn't get to see a proper rheumatologist until a few years ago. So I've spent most of my life self-managing my condition with a very deformed, damaged hip joint.
Wow.
So I think it's so great that the medications are there nowadays, and the outlook for children is so much brighter than it was, like, for me back then. And there are lessons I've learned through what I've been through that I don't want other people to go through. And part of that is understanding your own condition better so that you can advocate for yourself better. Because I think sometimes if I knew what I know now, maybe a few decades ago, my whole disease course might have been different. You know, there might be things that would have worked out better for me.
Yeah. Wow. That is totally makes sense when you say it like that, like that you were told there's nothing more they could do for you. And if you don't have regular checkups with the doctor, you don't know that there's been this gigantic shift in the 2000s in rheumatic disease care and treatments. I'm sad thinking about you suffering for all those years. And I mean, I'm wondering, how did you manage pregnancy and stuff like that? Where did you go into remission during pregnancy? Or
in many ways, it was kind of simpler not being on that kind of medication, because I know mm-hmm. there's so many considerations. If someone's on you know, DMARDs or biologics, they mm-hmm. have to, you know, be in close discussion with their doctor before they try and have a baby. So in a way, it took those worries out of the equation. But I do remember I did speak to my doctor, as in my general family mm-hmm. doctor, before we started a family. And the main thing I was concerned about was the mobility in my hip was very restricted.
Yeah.
And I remember discussing it with the midwife as well through pregnancy and saying, is this going to be a problem? Because I have such limited mobility in that hip, you know, that leg could barely move one way or another. And she said, oh, no, don't worry. It's not like on the telly. She said, it's not legs up in stirrups, wide apart. You know, yeah. Labour is very different from that. You can be in different positions. It, you know, it won't be an issue. But I feel they didn't really, like, no one examined my hip to actually check for themselves. So then through my first pregnancy and labour, sure enough, they said, right, now we need to put your legs in stirrups. And I'm like, I can't do that. So it did become an issue. So I ended up, I went through the whole of like labour until I was ready to give birth without any pain relief. And then at the very last moment, they said, oh, we are going to need to give you a spinal now. So that was kind of a bit disappointing. I thought, I wish either I'd had the spinal sooner so that I didn't have all the pain of the labor,
or
that they'd listen to me better kind of sooner to have kind of made a plan for it, really.
Yeah, I it's one of my little pet peeves, but I understand it, that so often doctors are like, they're trying to assuage your worries and fears and be like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be like, to make you feel better in the moment, but that's not helpful if it's not actually going to be okay long term. You know what I mean? They're like, I don't want to worry you. You're like, no, knowledge is power. Like, you know, I want to know. So I'm sorry that, yeah. I mean, as an occupational therapist, I'm sitting here like, oh my gosh, you're telling someone who has significant hip damage that's pregnant that there's going to be no problem, like, giving birth. Holy moly. And the problem is, you also don't want to, you don't want to necessarily cut off someone's sensation completely, because, I mean, I'm not an expert. This is not about childbirth, but when you cut off your sensation, when you cut off the sensation of pain through like a spinal, then if people are manipulating your body and you can't feel the pain, you don't get that signal that, oh, things are like in the wrong, you know, the ball was out of the socket in your hip joint or whatnot. So anyway, sorry, I don't mean to go down that rabbit hole, but I'm just, you know, I'm putting these puzzle pieces together. You've been through a lot. And I want to hear more about, you know, your experience being a mom, with juvenile idiopathic arthritis, but let's talk about demystifying, juvenile idiopathic arthritis. What happens if you as a child get diagnosed with JIA and then become an adult? I think what a lot of people think, which is that, well, when you're a kid, it's juvenile arthritis. And when you're an adult, it's adult arthritis, but actually that's not the case. So help us understand what's going on.
So again, this is another thing that came as a surprise to me when I learned about it. So having been out of the medical system for so long, I knew I'd been diagnosed with, it was actually called juvenile chronic arthritis back then. And I know it's gone by other names. I know in the States, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis is one of the names it's had previously, but it is in effect, it's juvenile idiopathic arthritis is the condition I had, but by a slightly different name. And so once I became an adult, I couldn't understand that it would be called juvenile, because juvenile means a young person. And so I just assumed I had, you know, when I'd go to the doctor and I'd say I've got arthritis, they'd say, oh, rheumatoid arthritis. And that's what the kind of the general practitioners, the GPs would write on my notes, rheumatoid arthritis. And I didn't know any better to correct them. So I thought, well, they're the doctor, they know. So it must be when you grow up, you have rheumatoid arthritis. And when you're a child, you have juvenile arthritis. And it was only when my own daughter was diagnosed, and I remember discussing it with one of her doctors, and I was saying, well, I've had arthritis since the age of 10. And I can't remember if I might have said something like, I now have rheumatoid arthritis. And they looked a bit puzzled. And I said, I'd never know quite how to explain my arthritis. And they said, well, you're an adult with JIA. And it was so obvious to them that that's what it is. You know, that a pediatric rheumatologist, they know that when you're an adult with JIA. But to me, that came as a shock. And I thought to myself, I felt a little bit kind of cheated all my life. Like I thought, why has no one told me this before? You know, surely somebody should have said, no, your condition is called JIA throughout your whole lifetime. So yeah, that came as a little bit of a surprise and a shock. So since then, that's something that I'm very aware of when I see people say, you know, I've had rheumatoid arthritis since the age of 5. I'm thinking to myself, no, if they were diagnosed, you know, before the age of 16, or not actually the diagnosis even, but the symptom onset before the age of 16, then it is juvenile idiopathic arthritis. So I know sometimes teenagers, they may get diagnosed age kind of 17, 18, but their symptoms have been there prior to the age of 16. So, you know, that in that case, it is also juvenile idiopathic arthritis. So basically, if your symptoms have been there before the age of 16, it's JIA, and it doesn't change. It doesn't automatically become rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, or any other type of arthritis. It remains called juvenile idiopathic arthritis throughout your life. And hopefully in many cases, people do go into remission either through medication or spontaneous unmedicated remission. And that's what we always hope for, but that diagnosis is for life and how it's named.
Yeah. And that's really helpful for me to review, because yeah, I know for sure I was diagnosed at 21 and my symptoms started at 19, and they said, you know, you have adult rheumatoid arthritis. There are kids that have, you know, a similar condition, but, cause I think that they evaluated whether I might've had JIA, because I had so many things that I thought were injuries, as you know, I was a soccer player, very sporty, like you, football player, as they call it in the UK. But the other thing I want to talk about that a lot of people don't know is that juvenile idiopathic arthritis and rheumatoid arthritis are different diseases with different prognoses. They have, if you have a Venn diagram, of course, you're going to overlap on the fact of, you know, joint inflammation caused by your immune system, similar to like psoriatic arthritis, joint pain, or, you know, ankylosing spondylitis. But JIA, what are some of the other, sorry, I didn't prepare you for this, but I'm guessing, you know, off the top of your head, what are some of the other things that are different for JIA in terms of either the long-term prognosis or the medications and stuff like that versus RA?
So JAA itself, as you will know, is not one condition. That is made up of several subtypes, which are different conditions themselves. One of those subtypes is more similar to rheumatoid arthritis, which again doesn't help with the whole confusion thing. And many of the medications are either similar or the same, and many of the challenges we face. So when I watch your videos on Instagram and all the tips and things, you know, all the advice you give, I think, yeah, a lot of that is relevant, you know, to me and for those with JAA. So a lot of the challenges we face are similar. People get it, you know, the fatigue does affect children with JAA, and fatigue can affect people with RA. A lot of the symptoms, like you say, the joint pain and stiffness and, you know, morning stiffness and that kind of thing, there are many, many similarities. And I just want to start by saying I'm not a medical expert. I'm not a doctor. So in terms of the actual detail of the conditions, I do not personally know enough about which medications, you know, how the medications and things would vary. I don't have the answers to those myself, but I do know it is really, really important to get that labeling right and to get that naming right, because one of the questions that as a parent I have, and I hear other parents have all the time, is they want to know, you know, how are things going to be in the long run for my child? Mm-hmm. And the truth is that the answers to that are not known. And one of the reasons for that is because of this mislabeling that's happened. So the research when the researchers look at the doctor's records and the GP's records, because they cannot see for sure which adults would have had JAA because it's then been renamed on their records as RA, it makes it a lot harder for when they're carrying out those research projects. There is work being done as we speak to try and look at the long-term outcomes and the long-term prognosis. But to date, that's been something very, very hard to establish because of this kind of mislabeling and, you know, people not understanding themselves what their condition is in the longer term.
Yeah, this is maybe a little bit old, but I remember reading on the Arthritis Foundation website that the rates of remission for juvenile idiopathic arthritis are thought to be higher than adult rheumatoid arthritis. But maybe you just pointed out that maybe that's not based on actual, maybe they look artificially lower because those people are now who grow up are not considering themselves to have JAA anymore.
I think, and again, I would have to check very specifically, but I think the remission rates for JAA are around 50%, and I think that's something that's not been changed since I was a child. So since 30 years ago, the remission rates were largely the same. And I think you're right in what you say, because
it's definitely lower.
Particularly for kind of rheumatoid factor positive arthritis, you know, that's a harder one to get under control and to get into remission, from what I understand. But you probably know more about this than I do.
I'm just looking at the Arthritis Foundation website as we're talking. I'm always like, have 12 tabs open in my brain. But it looks like it's 10 to 30% of people go into remission from RA who were not treated or who are not I'm trying to say this exactly how they said it. For people who don't begin treatment within 2 years of first symptoms or who don't start biologics early, remission will range from 10 to 33%. And that's talking about medicated remission. So that's the other thing. We can get those statistics. I can put them in the show notes. But like you're saying, you know, it's almost, we have to remind ourselves when we look at these statistics that they are not necessarily perfectly representative because of this issue with it used to being in the US, like you mentioned, juvenile idiopathic arthritis was called juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And also there's, you know, this, I'm glad you reminded me, I always think when I'm saying JIA, I'm thinking about the systemic JAA, or like the polyarticular, the one that's more similar to rheumatoid arthritis, adult rheumatoid arthritis. But there are other kinds that are, you know, only one joint affected and not as systemic. So so there's a lot as we're uncovering here.
Of what you said about that kind of window of opportunity, we know that is true for JAA as well, which is why the prompt diagnosis and prompt treatment is so important, because that window of opportunity does improve the chances of, you know, long-term outcomes being improved as well. So that is, you know, still very relevant and very important as well.
Yeah. And the reason I jumped to that statistic of 10 to 33%, because it's the people who weren't treated within the first 2 years of symptoms, because we know that most people don't get diagnosed till like 4 or 5 years after their first symptoms, because they're being thrown around like you are, you know, being told you're not sick, you're just anxious, or you're just trying to get out of things. And that happens, unfortunately, to adults, just like it does to kids, which is such a shame. But you know, speaking of all these, we both of us have noticed lots of problems in the medical system and in general awareness of, different kinds of arthritis, but I know that you're doing stuff to help solve some of these problems through the Juvenile Arthritis Research Charity. So can you share a little bit more about that and what you do and what are the things you're excited about for like 2024 coming up, which is currently now actually?
So we founded the charity 6 years ago now, and it was my husband who decided to go back to his roots in biomedical research, having had, you know, myself as his wife who'd grown up and he'd seen how it's impacted my life, and then to have a daughter with a condition and to see how little things had changed in terms of awareness, and in terms of obviously the medication side of things has vastly improved, but there was very little in the way of like supporting families and supporting children through this. So he decided that wasn't good enough and someone has to do something. And he thought, well, why not me? You know, instead of moaning about it, we, you know, let's make a difference. So he founded the charity, and the ultimate vision is we want to see a world where no child has to suffer from arthritis. So ultimately that will be a cure of some kind, whether that is in terms of prevention or finding a permanent solution to make sure every child reaches permanent remission. We don't know what that will look like, but that is what we're pushing for with, you know, the research we're involved in. And we have three kind of core aims that most of our work falls into. So it either falls into awareness, research, or support side of things. And we do so much in 6 short years. We actually do so much thanks to the volunteers within the charity. We've grown to a network of around 25 volunteers now to support families.
Wow.
And it's just been amazing, you know, to see how needed it was. And that's why we've just grown and grown, because, you know, the need was there. And in terms of research, we're very excited that towards the end of last year, we launched a new project in the UK, which we've called the JAA VIP Research Panel. And that's where families can sign up to say, yes, I'm interested in taking part in research. I'm interested in finding out more about research opportunities. And we can then link them up when there are projects with universities and hospitals or pharmaceuticals, anyone that's looking for families affected by JAA to take part in research. We've got this pool of people who are already interested and they're willing to, you know, be part of research. So that's a really exciting thing we've launched, you know, last year, and that's continuing to build. And we've got new projects coming up all the time for that panel of people who want to kind of be involved.
Really quick question. Are these for people just in the United Kingdom, or is it worldwide for research?
At the moment, our research panel is in the UK.
Okay.
We have had people from various other countries saying, hey, can you help us do this, you know, in our country? And I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be able to be rolled out. At the moment, it's more of a capacity issue because we are a very small charity. Yes. And as I said, we're, you know, run by volunteers. So it's all kind of fitting in addition to everything else we have going on in our lives. But there's no reason in future why that's not something that could be rolled out to make it available more widely. But at the moment, that is UK only. In terms of our support services and support information, again, the physical resources that we send out. So when a child is diagnosed with JAA, they will hear about us either through their hospital or if they go online and search for information. We have these what we call little box of hope packs that we send out to them.
Oh, I love that.
That was an idea by a lovely young volunteer of ours called Abby. And when she was 7 years old, she said to her mum, I don't like the idea of children being diagnosed JAA and not having anyone to turn to. So we need to do something. So she came up with this idea of sending them a little pack with all the information and everything in there that they need. So for the younger children, that includes a storybook called Kippo. And we send a little Kippo finger puppet, which brings the story to life. And they get some other information. So we have a booklet called My JAA, which is kind of a guide to, you know, living with JAA, and it's got information for schools in there and what to expect when you get a diagnosis, and, you know, lots, it's just packed with information. So it's a really good booklet, and we have, you know, various other bits of information that go in there. And Abby still to this day, she handwrites a little note for every child who receives one of those packs.
Gosh.
So it really kind of encourages them and gives them hope to think,
wow,
you know, there's someone out there that cares about me. And we found quite soon that actually for the children who are slightly older, kind of over the age of 10, they were finding like the Kippo storybook a bit young for them. Mm-hmm. So another young lad called Ned, he wrote a story for teenagers. So he loved the Wimpy Kid books, The Diary of a Wimpy Kid books.
Yeah.
So he wrote it in that kind of style. And that's mm-hmm. been published, and that's included in packs for kind of older children. So if you're age 10 and over in the UK, you'd receive one of these, what we call teen support packs. And there's no upper age limit. So I know people as adults who've requested one and they go, wow, this, you know, this story reflects, you know, my experience, and they really relate to it as well. So yeah, that's been really brilliant that we can do that. And we do also, we often get inquiries from elsewhere in the world, and they say, please, can you send me a pack? And we can't, unfortunately, send it outside of the UK because of various, you know, charity regulations in the UK.
Mm.
But we do try and make all of that information available on our website as well. So all of our booklets and publications, by going to the website, jarproject.org, you can find all that information to download as well, and lots of other resources on there as well.
That's amazing. I think the Arthritis Foundation in the United States does something similar with like a teddy bear and a little backpack. And it definitely strikes me what you said about, you know, adults want this stuff too. Like we all, I know there's so many in the US, there's so many regulations around like what you can, even what you can put on the wall at a rheumatologist office, right? Like a flyer or anything, much less giving people these packets. But we all want that human touch. You know, we all feel alone sometimes in having these, you know, health challenges. So having something come to you, like a physical thing in the mail, you know, that tells you that someone cares about you and someone wants to give you a little box of hope, I think that's really incredible. And yeah, I mean, I just started Arthritis Life a few years ago, but I'm really in awe of people who are able to, like, you know, scale and manage volunteers and manage lots of people, because that's one thing I've been trying in a small way to do. And it's really hard. Like I've worked for small organizations before, or what, no, grassroots, as we call them in the US. I don't know if you call them that in the UK too, but it takes a lot of work. So I'm commending you, like giving you arthritis friendly claps here.
If you have ever felt completely lost or utterly alone while trying to navigate real life with rheumatic disease, listen up, I am here for you. I created an educational program to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks, and it's called Room to Thrive. After earning a master's in occupational therapy and completing hundreds of hours of additional training, I created a step-by-step guide to help you truly thrive with rheumatic disease. This is the only program I know of that's designed to improve quality of life for people living with inflammatory, autoimmune forms of arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, Sjogren's disease, and more. During the self-paced lessons, you'll learn how to manage pain and fatigue, cope with stress, navigate relationships, and continue doing the things that matter to you and bring you joy. The goal is really to help you improve your quality of life and learn how to thrive with your rheumatic disease right now, rather than waiting for a distant day when it might be cured or healed. I really created the down-to-earth, practical, heartfelt resource I wish I had had when I was first diagnosed at age 20. If you want even more in-depth support, you can join the 12-week Room to Thrive virtual support group, where you'll be surrounded by people who actually get what you're going through, people who will provide the encouragement, validation, and support that you deserve. Each group is expertly moderated, so you don't have to worry about the kind of misinformation that spreads like wildfire in the free-for-all social media groups. If you're on the fence, don't just take my word for it. Here's what Katie had to say in March 2023. I was lost and overwhelmed with my RA diagnosis. It felt overwhelming to know what to read, what to do, how to spend my energy trying to research on the internet. Room to Thrive did that for me. It's been like getting a crash course in my diagnosis along with a community who gets it. To see all the details, including the dates for the next support groups, go to the link in the show notes or bit.ly/thriveroom with a capital T and capital R. You can also just email me anytime at info@myarthritislife.net. And don't delay if you're interested, because each group is capped at 16 people or less in order to make a small, intimate group atmosphere. Thanks so much for your time, and I can't wait to get started with the next groups. And I can't wait for those of you who are interested in the self-paced option to go ahead and join that at any time. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you.
I hope you guys, you and your husband and family, take time to, you know, revel in what you've created, because sometimes I know when you're so passionate about what you're doing, it's like, you just want to keep doing it. Like, how, actually, okay, this off the top of my head, how do you have a balance in your life? Because if your work is so important to you, but you also need to rest sometimes too.
So I'm so grateful to our volunteers, because as more volunteers have come on board, they have helped so much with everything we do. So I'm so grateful to them, because before we got to that stage, it was mainly myself, my husband, and Sam and Abby, who send out the packs for the young children. It was mainly us three doing everything. So as we've grown and more volunteers have come on board, we've been able to share some of the workload. So as well as the support we give to families, we also have things like school packs. So we have a volunteer that sends out packs to schools with specific information for them. And we have another volunteer that does the packs for the teenagers that she sends them out. So all of these people coming on board has just really, really helped us a lot. And sometimes I don't think they realize just how big a help they are to us. So I just want to publicly say thank you to our volunteers, because they are amazing. And they all have conditions of their own. Either they have a child with JAA or they have arthritis themselves. So actually, it's a big deal that they're giving up their time to help us. And we're just so, so grateful for that. In terms of getting the balance right, I don't feel I'm there yet. And I don't know if I ever will be, because I think I'm one of those people that I kind of throw myself into everything, like fully, wholeheartedly, passionately into everything.
Yes.
And so I do find it really, really hard to take that kind of time out and take a step back from things. And we will often be sending emails, you know, almost at midnight. We'll be there still working away, getting things done, because we kind of have to, because we think there's no one else actually doing this out there. So if we don't do it, who's going to do it? So we just keep going. And when we don't expect thanks from people, but when we get those messages of thanks from parents that have said, I didn't know who to turn to, thank you for being there. And even over the Christmas break, I kind of look after the social media. So we had a lot of direct messages coming in where everything else is closed. They can't get hold of their hospital teams, any other kind of helplines out there. They closed down over the Christmas break, and people are messaging us saying, I'm really worried, or I'm really stuck on this. And we can't give medical advice, but we can be that listening ear, and we can say,
yeah,
you know, just help them along the way, or signpost them to information that we have online, or, you know, just help them how we can. And I just think, you know, that makes it all worthwhile, knowing that you've been there to help someone at the time they most needed it. And I know when I was younger, if I'd had someone to turn to, I think it would have just made things so much easier. We want to be there in that gap where there wasn't support before to help families.
That's incredible. And I relate to you with that. I was laughing to myself as you were talking about working over the weekend, because it's Monday when we're recording this, and you and I both emailed a couple of times this weekend. And so, yeah, I think you're right that there's never this elusive, perfect sense of balance. But I think what I'm seeing from your story is that you've delegated stuff to volunteers, which is my big skill I'm working on in 2024, because I'm kind of a control freak. So I'm like, I need help. But then it's like, when it's time for me to delegate, I'm like, I have to do it all. You're like, wait, no, you need to delegate. It's going to be okay. And that, yeah, that you're, you know, I think when you are so passionate about something, sometimes it's so corny to say, but it's like, it's not work when it's like your passion, you know, but you still do, as someone with a chronic health condition, we do have to remember to rest and, you know, not burn the candle at both ends, you know, as they say. But one thing that is different about your story than mine is that you have a child with juvenile idiopathic arthritis. My son, it's definitely something I keep my eyes out for. He, to my knowledge, doesn't have, you know, any autoimmune condition. I did take him once, side note, into the doctor, just so people don't feel silly who've done this. I took him to the doctor when he was like 2, because he was limping. And I was like, okay, you know, this is it. He's getting JAA. And they're like, he has a splinter. And they took the splinter out. And I was like, oh, thank you. They're like, but we're so glad you came, because most people wouldn't know that could be a sign, you know, of JIA, or could be a sign, who knows? But it was just so funny. They're like, yes, he has a splinter.
It's always best to get things checked out. I always say to parents, if you're ever worried, get it checked out, because it's worse to just keep worrying or to not know, you know, and it is that early diagnosis is so important that it is better to, you know, just go and, you know, have your mind put at rest, or, you know, just to know what's going on.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. So I'm curious, that whatever you want to share about your experience, you know, with your daughter at the age of two developing JIA, what's that been like as a mom supporting her through this?
Yes. Yeah, so she started with what we thought was an injury, which is quite a common way that, you know, children often get misdiagnosed as, you know, being told, oh, it's a sports injury, or, you know, that they've injured themselves without it being considered to be JIA. So yeah, she had an injury to her ankle and it kind of swelled up. And we took her a few times to our doctor and said, you know, this isn't getting better. But they couldn't see anything obvious wrong. They x-rayed it a few times and we got sent home. And in my mind, it didn't even occur to me at that point that it could be JIA, because my initial symptoms in the hip, there was no swelling because there was nowhere really for the swelling to go. So I didn't put two and two together. So I didn't think it could, you know, it didn't even occur to me that it could be JIA. And it was only more as time went on and they put her foot in a plaster cast. And it, when the plaster came off, she then couldn't walk at all because it'd been immobilized for so long, which we now know that's kind of a really not a good thing to do with, you know, with arthritis. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel we were lucky in the sense that when the orthopedic consultant wasn't really getting anywhere, he called in very informally. He had a very good relationship with the pediatrician, and he called her into the appointment that day and said, you know, do you know what's going on here? Because I can't find anything wrong. And she had seen JIA before, so she was familiar and knew that this could be JIA. So she made the referral to Great Ormond Street Hospital, which is where our pediatric rheumatology service is and our closest one. And from then on, she got quickly diagnosed, started on methotrexate quickly, and she's had a very successful outcome. So her kind of life has been very different to what mine was. So she was soon, once the medication kicked in, she was soon able to go back to her sports and walking and running and playing and all the things she loves doing. I remember initially I did feel a kind of guilt once we knew what she had, because I thought, oh my goodness, is it because I've got JIA that she's got JIA? Because, you know, there are these links, as in, you know, of autoimmune conditions, that there is that kind of hereditary link, even though the full genetics of it isn't understood yet. And even though logically I kept telling myself, well, guilt is not going to help either her or me. And I knew that, but I couldn't help feeling that way to start with. I felt relief that once we found out what was wrong, because even though her diagnosis was relatively quick, in that period of waiting, you're still thinking, you know, what is this? What could be wrong? And all those worries are going through your mind. But then once we did know what it was, I kind of felt, okay, so if she's got JIA and I had JIA and I've had, you know, I've managed to live with it and I've been okay, she'll be okay. And it kind of gave me that hope to know she'll be okay. And of course, with the medications as well, as we learned more about, you know, how good and effective they are, it kind of gave us even more hope to say, actually, her life's, you know, going to be very different from mine. She's not, hopefully not going to get that long-term joint damage and everything else that I had with her. Again, it was different to mine. So she was affected in multiple joints with polyarticular JIA. So she had her left ankle, her right knee, her fingers, her jaws affected. So she had, you know, various joints affected, but she's doing really well at the moment. And, you know, we can't wish for more really from that point of view.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to just fixate on this, but you just mentioned jaw, which made me want to say that's another differentiator between JIA and RA, because RA rarely affects the jaw. It can, but not nearly as high of a rate as jaw inflammation seen in JIA. So that's just another thing to throw out there. So if you're an adult who had a history of, you know, who has a diagnosis of juvenile idiopathic arthritis, that's something you want to keep looking out for. You're not suddenly not prone to that because you're an adult. But yeah, that's, I mean, it really is a testament, and I mean, to the way that the treatments have changed over the last few decades, that she's, you know, doing so well, despite having more joints involved typically would give you a worse prognosis, but then you with only, quote unquote, only one joint involved, although it was involved very heavily. but yeah, that's, you know, hopeful. I'm hoping, cross fingers gently, that she, you know, continues to do well on methotrexate. I'm in the methotrexate club with her.
And has it been, has anything kind of been challenging with her, or any tips to share from, I'm thinking about the school environment. Are there any tips you give other parents? Because that's one of the FAQs I get when I volunteer with my local arthritis foundation summer camps, the juvenile arthritis summer family camps. And sometimes parents ask, you know, like, how do I get her teachers to understand? I mean, it sounds like maybe your daughter doesn't need accommodations right now, but have you had to explain it to her teachers at all that she might need an accommodation or she might be sore some days?
Yeah. So she's in the UK. She's been at primary school up until last September, and then she's changed to secondary school.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, it was really, really important to find the right secondary school for her where they would understand. We were very fortunate that her primary school were very, very flexible. So where she has experienced fatigue, she'd be allowed to do half a day and they'd let her come home. But obviously, as she's got older, it's more important that she stays in, you know, in her classes and doesn't miss her lessons. So, we have had to put things in place to help her. And I just feel we have been fortunate in the schools she has been at and the teachers she's had that they have been very understanding. I think it does help if your medical team, if they're willing to support parents where schools aren't understanding so much. So that's one of the things we've developed on our website. We actually have a letter template that we worked with some rheumatologists to develop, and that can be downloaded and kind of amended to make it relevant to each child and then sent from the hospital. So the hospital can print it on their headed paper and send it to the school or give it to the parent to give to school. And that just seems to carry more weight than a parent just saying, you know, this is what's wrong with my child. Because I think with JAA, it is largely in many cases an invisible condition now because the medication is so effective. Because people can't obviously see there's something wrong, it does make it harder to understand. So that letter is one of the things that really, really does help. And even with our amazing understanding school that we had, when they got a letter from the doctor, it kind of made it, it was like their eyes were open to, oh, we didn't realize she goes through all of this. You know,
yes.
So it's getting them to understand that the child they see in front of them, to kind of have that normal life, or as normal a life as possible, they actually go through a lot. You know, they have those weekly injections, they have blood tests every few weeks, they have x-rays, MRIs, you know, their life is full of hospital appointments. So actually, although the outcome is quite good in the sense that they can go and join in with activities and things, there's a lot that goes into that behind the scenes. And I think mm-hmm. it's just getting the school to really understand that. And once they do, I think they're a lot more accommodating and understanding of what that child needs. And I think the biggest tip I would give to parents and schools is plan for the worst. So plan for the worst days, plan for those bad days. So at my daughter's school, when we were looking around for which school she would go to, I was checking for wheelchair access because I knew that if things get worse, she will be back in that wheelchair. If, you know, if she flares and it'll take a while to get it under control, you know, so, you know, checking for wheelchair access, making sure they've got lifts, making sure they understand, you know, how variable her condition can be day to day. So whilst on the whole the treatment's working, there are still some days that she may be in pain or really fatigued and struggling to join in with all her lessons. So they've given her a kind of timeout card where she can go to like student services, and if she needs a break from lessons, she has that flexibility to like leave the lesson and go and sit there and just have a rest. So yeah, they've been brilliant in doing every little thing we could ask for. And I think things like again on the JAR project website, there is a school fact sheet, and that's got some tips mm-hmm. that any school could put in place. So it's things like having access to a locker, maybe being given a second set of textbooks, so it's not too heavy to carry around, you know, from home mm-hmm. to school. You can leave one set at school, have one set at home, although nowadays a lot of the learning is electronic, so it's probably a bit less of an issue. Being aware of things that perhaps you wouldn't immediately think of, so children on methotrexate and some other medications may be more prone to sunburn, so they may mm-hmm. need help reapplying, you know, sun lotion in the middle of the day at school in the summer months, and those kinds of things. So and wearing supportive shoes as well is the other thing. The number of times I hear from parents, oh, my child is being told they have to wear like proper school shoes because it's not school uniform to wear like trainers or sneakers.
Right. We don't have uniforms here unless it's a private school. So yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Here it's often, you know, school shoes are black school shoes, and particularly for girls, they're not very supportive, you know, generally the school shoes you get. So, you know, Trinity, my daughter, she's always been allowed to wear trainers to school because they're more supportive and it's what her physiotherapist has recommended. So she's, you know, she's allowed to wear those, and school's been great about that. So something quite simple, really, and makes a big difference to that child.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's such a, what's the word? It's the same principle applies to accommodations in the workplace as well, or looking at different places to work when you're an adult, to say like, okay, how accommodating could this workplace possibly be? I mean, there's all sorts of laws and stuff in the United States that govern whether or not that, you know, you're going to be given reasonable accommodations. But like you're saying, thinking about the principle of planning for your worst day and explaining the variability, the fluctuations to your potential employer or your teacher or your, you know, your college professor, those are such crucial things. So I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but in case you're like a new listener, I've been really disappointed at times when I used to work as a school-based occupational therapist. I overheard, you know, a case where someone was like, well, this kid has juvenile arthritis, but like, and they're supposed to have accommodations, be able to sit out from PE or physical education or gym, you know, and, but I saw them running on the playground the other day. And I'm like, well, you don't get it. Like, you don't get, just because they can run around the playground yesterday does not mean they can do it today. And so I know I'm preaching to the choir, to you and anyone listening.
We hear exactly the same, you know, that story. I could have told that exact same story. It happens all around the world, and it's not right. And until that level of awareness and understanding is there, you know, throughout every community, I think we're always going to hear stories like that, sadly. So, you know, that's why what you do and what we do is so important in helping to change, you know, change what's happening out there.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Thank you. I feel good. Sometimes I forget, because I'm like, it's hard if you're like a problem solving type person, because you're like, there's still so many problems. But you're like, no, I have to take a second and say good job for what we've done. And I like, there's that old parable of the person like throwing, I almost said seahorses, starfish into the ocean. One at a time. And it's like, it made a difference to that one. I have to remind myself that every day.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that story. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This is great. I mean, I do want to respect your time, and I have some rapid fire questions that are potentially could be a whole hour because they're like big questions. But do you have any best words of wisdom for children or adults who newly understand that they have juvenile idiopathic arthritis still, or people diagnosed with JIA?
Yep. So I think I'd mainly say it does get easier. I think those early days are so overwhelming, and I think it can be a really scary time. It can be a lonely time. But just hold on to that hope that it does get easier. So the medications, you kind of get used to them, and you kind of get to the point where you know what you're doing. I always tell the story of how my daughter, when she was first diagnosed, we ended up on 11, like it was 11 times a day we had to give her different medications because she had uveitis as well. So it was like eye drops 4 times a day. And she was, before the methotrexate kicked in, she needed naproxen several times. You know, so it was kind of everything was kind of building up. And I had alarms set, you know, 11 points through the day to give her medications. And that was overwhelming, as well as her hospital appointments and everything else that was going on. So it definitely does get easier, because generally, as the condition gets under control and improves, you know, things become a lot more manageable, and you kind of adjust to that new, your new normality of, you know, this is what our life is like now. And you do make that adjustment as well. So, it gets easier. Hang on in there.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And do you have a favorite, or you or your daughter have a favorite arthritis gadget or tool in your toolbox?
So I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, I don't necessarily have a favorite gadget as such, because I have used crutches for several times, you know, during my life when I had my hip replaced and as a teenager, and other times when I'm having a bad flare. But for me, I think it's more of something to remember is actually, no one knows your body as well as you do. So I think it's more about listening to your body and doing what feels right for you. So in the past, I've come a bit unstuck when a physiotherapist has said, you've got to do these exercises and this will help you. And I've really tried hard and done them, and it's kind of made me worse. And I wish I'd kind of said to them at the time, this isn't working out for me, so that they could adjust it. So the latest physio I saw, actually, I was very honest with her about my limitations. And so she was very mindful of, you know, really gentle exercises that would help me rather than perhaps going too far that, you know, kind of making things worse. So, you know, with listening to the advice of your doctors and physiotherapists and your medical team, just have that discussion and say, you know, if this is not going to work for me, to kind of be open with them and let them know. So, you know, trust that you know your own body better than other people do, I think. Having said that, actually, my bed is a very firm bed and I couldn't manage without that. So it's probably bigger than a gadget or tool, but, you know, having a very firm bed is really important.
Yeah, and I'm realizing that a gadget or tool is really more for, I'm biased towards people with hand issues or upper extremity issues because that's where my rheumatoid arthritis is most active. So I'm thinking those little ones like the kitchen openers and stuff. But yeah, firm bed is huge, especially for hip pain. You know, if that helps, you know, you're sleeping, your sleep ergonomics, you know? I certainly understand that. And I think, yeah, listening to your body is such a tricky one. It's such a tricky one because there's different kinds of pain. Like I was explaining to someone the other day about how, like, I've started strength training and I know how to push through, or I know that it's okay in my body to push through muscle pain, but not joint pain, you know, but I can really feel the difference between those two. But for somebody who might be new to exercise, they might not, you know, you just have to, yeah. Like you said, you've lived it for so long now that you have got a good sense of your body, you know, and takes a lot of advocacy to tell that to a physiotherapist. So good job. Do you have a favorite? This is literally, I just love talking about like pop culture or like culture, whatever we call it. Do you have a favorite book or movie or show you have been into?
Yeah. So I kind of feel I missed out on reading as a child because I don't remember having many like books. I think I only had like two or three kind of storybooks on my shelf. I didn't have many books, whereas my children are blessed to have so many books to choose from. So I kind of came to reading really only once I had children and it became my little bit of me time was to grab a book and read. So yeah, now I love to read. If I can find time to read or make time to read, you know, I love reading. So a friend lent me Lessons in Chemistry just recently. I absolutely loved that book. But yes. I just have to mention my very favourite author is Kristen Hannah, and I love all of her. Every book I've read by her, I absolutely love it. She just has such great kind of characters. And there's another author, Victoria Hislop, and she writes historical fiction. And I really love all of her books. And I think the first one I started on was called The Island. And I don't know if you read it or if you know about it. But
no, I read I'm a minute behind you. I read The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. Yeah.
That was my first Kristen Hannah book I read. And then at the back of that one, it had a little bit about one of her other books. So then I went on to read that and I just haven't stopped. I've just made my way through pretty much all of her books now.
That's what I do too. I find an author I like and I just like devour everything they've ever written. I love it. Okay. Thank you for, reminding me because I read just The Nightingale. I didn't read any others.
Oh, yeah. I'll quickly finish mentioning about The Island because it's set in time. Yes. And it's about like the condition of leprosy, and it just inspired me so much that in that person's lifetime that the story's about, a cure for leprosy was found. So I kind of think if that can happen within one person's lifetime, why can't it happen for JIA? You know, that's kind of what I hold on to. So I absolutely love it. It's a fictional book, but based on kind of real life events at the time. So yeah, I find that hugely inspiring.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you.
I'm so sorry. I'm going to take up all your time.
No, do it.
I have a favorite movie as well that I have to mention. Oh, yes. And that's Lorenzo's Oil. Have you watched Lorenzo's Oil?
No, I don't think so. I've heard of it.
And again, that is is based on a true story. And this young lad, and I can't remember the exact condition because it's been many years since I watched it, but it's his dad that finds the cure for the condition. Although it can't cure him because it's kind of degenerated to a certain point, the cure that's found has helped all the children since then that have this condition. And so, yeah, so when my husband said, actually, I want to find a cure for JAA, I was thinking, well, the odds are in his favour because he's got a biological scientific background. So, yeah, let's go for it.
That's like my favourite kind of people are the people who like just say, here's a problem. Like, I'm going to do something. Like, I'm going to. Yeah. And I don't know if you listened to the episode from the Ben Arroyo Research Institute on my podcast, but they're in Seattle actually, but they, the researchers there were saying, I was actually shocked
that they said that they think a cure for adult rheumatoid arthritis will come in my lifetime. Because usually PhD scientists don't say that unless they really think it will happen. So that's episode one.
I hope so. I so hope so. And I'm always so encouraged to hear about, you know, the latest research. And I know you're very much into, you know, finding out all the latest research and developments, because it is encouraging. Everything that's going on out there, there is so much to be encouraged by, whether it's new treatments coming on board or the more that they're finding out about, you know, the condition. It helps us understand it better. So yeah, no, there's a lot of good science going on.
I think I'm again crossing our fingers for us. Do you have a favorite mantra or inspirational saying?
Yep. So I have two for this one, if that's okay, if I'm allowed
to. Yeah, of course.
One of them is, it's never too late to be who you might have been. And I don't know who said that, but I remember seeing it once and I thought, yeah, I'm having that quote as one of my quotes. And I remember when I had my hip replaced, and that was 6 years ago. 6 years ago tomorrow, actually. Tomorrow's my hip anniversary.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you when you got it. Okay, so it's after both your kids were born?
All three of my children, yes.
Oh, three. I thought you had two for some unknown reason. Okay. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
But I remember lying in that hospital bed, and for me, I found it a difficult operation to go through, because everything I tried to read about beforehand, it was all aimed at older, you know, 70-year-olds having a hip replacement. There was very little out there for anyone. I was 40 years old at the time. There was very little information out there for kind of my age group. So I did, on my personal blog, I documented the whole thing, and I ended up, you know, writing up about it, because I thought, if someone else is looking for that information, I want there to be something out there. And I remember lying in that hospital bed and thinking, you know, if I get through this, I can get through anything. And yeah, so that quote is up there as a kind of reminder of that, you know, it's never too late to be who you might have been. And it's just a reminder to get out of your comfort zone and follow your heart, try something different, see what happens. And my second favorite quote, and I think this goes back to what we've been talking about hoping for a cure for these conditions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a Nelson Mandela quote, and it says, "It always seems impossible until it's done."
Yeah.
And I just love that, because there are people that we've come across that they almost don't dare to believe that it's possible that, you know, a cure could be found and that things can improve. And actually we want to believe that, and we want to see it happen. And when it does happen, it will be like, oh, okay, so it was possible. And so that quote kind of reflects that belief that, you know, one day we'll get there and, you know, it will happen.
I love it. What has been bringing you joy recently or right now?
I think I just try to appreciate the little things in life, really. So when I wake up and I'm having a less bad day and my back's not so stiff and I feel like, yeah, you know, today I could maybe do a household chore, or, you know, something that other people probably wouldn't find that exciting. I kind of feel, you know, if I feel able to do it that day, that I feel quite happy about that. Or, you know, if I make time to have a bit of time to myself to read a book, or, you know, that those sorts of things, just little things that I just kind of appreciate. And even something simple as being able to walk, you know, I kind of never take that for granted, because I've had to relearn to walk like three times in my life, you know, after being on crutches, after my hip replacement. So I just never take something like that for granted, because I think, you know, there was a time I couldn't do it and I had to learn again how to do it. So
yeah, absolutely. I cannot stop myself from asking this. Back from two questions ago, but I was gonna ask, when you read, do you read on a like an e-reader, an electronic reader, or do you read physical books or audiobooks? How do you like to consume books?
I prefer physical books, because I kind of like to know where I am in a book and see how much further I've got to go. And I definitely prefer a physical book, but for practical reasons. So if I am going for a hospital appointment to London and I'm going to be carrying a book, you know, with me, I kind of think, well, actually, I might as well get an ebook on my phone, because then it's one less thing to carry. So I'm always weighing up, you know, the practicalities of it as well, because the carrying is because I do get a lot of back pain, you know, linked to my arthritis and my condition. So I always try and balance it up. But my preference is a physical book. I'm not very good with audio stuff, because I don't particularly like listening to music, because I find I can't concentrate on anything else. And it's the opposite in the rest of my family. My children and my husband, they need music in the background, and I'm like, no, I need it quiet, because I need to concentrate. And it's the same for things like podcasts. If I want to listen, I prefer, when you have a transcript of your podcast, I prefer to read through the transcript, because I'm just, and YouTube videos and things, I just don't I find I can't do anything else. Some people might be able to listen and do something else, whereas I can't. If I am listening to a podcast, I will have to sit there and listen to that. You know, that is all I'm doing at that moment. So in reality, I prefer to have something to read through. If I can read, you know, if I can read it, I prefer that usually.
Yeah, that's why I provide the transcripts. I actually, when I'm learning something new in particular, auditory is not my strong, it's my weakest learning method. Like I need to, typically I would like to read something to get it into my head. That being said, I can multitask when listening to podcasts. So I love to listen while I'm like cooking or, you know, but if it's a really important part, I will sometimes pause it if I have to like focus on something else. But anyway, that's just, it's just a little debate that was going on in my Instagram stories of like, do you prefer the e-readers or audiobooks or physical books? But yeah, sometimes it can, for me with thumb and finger pain, it can be hard to hold open the book. So yeah. I like to do the e-reader. Okay, but back to the list. What does it mean to you to live a good life and thrive with rheumatic disease?
I absolutely love the way you word that question to say, you know, a good life. And it's not a great life, it's not a normal life, but a good life. I love that wording because it reminds me of one of the mums that I'm in contact with. She always tells me, she says, you helped me see that my child can have a good life despite having JEA. And she uses that word, you know, a good life. And I think it kind of accurately reflects the fact that the things that we've talked about already, you know, there are still challenges, there are side effects of medication, there's everything else that goes alongside having a chronic condition. So it kind of probably isn't accurate to say, you know, normal life, but it's a good life is a good way to think of it. So I feel, in my case, I feel despite my scenario perhaps being one of the worst in terms of, you know, the hip damage was done, there were no medications, no treatments, I didn't have a rheumatologist for all those years. So despite all of that situation being kind of really bad, worst case scenario type situation, I look back at my life and I think I have had a good life. I feel, you know, I've achieved all the milestones I wanted to achieve. So, you know, I went to university, I had a job that I wanted to have, you know, had my children, got married, you know, all of those things that I wanted to do, I've been able to do in spite of, you know, all the odds being against me in terms of, you know, my condition. And I just think for children nowadays, the outlook is so much brighter than that. So there's absolutely nothing that needs to stop them from, you know, if they've got JEA, they can follow their dreams, they can do whatever they want. And I think as parents, we should encourage our children with JEA not limit them in any way. And, you know, my daughter, she loves penguins and she always says, I want to be a penguinologist.
That's my favorite animal. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I love penguins.
You have a lot in common with her, with your Taylor Swift, you know.
Yes, and I love the penguins. We could do a global tour of looking at the 17 species of penguins and then Taylor Swift concerts. See it all now.
She's got a whole book she made when she was younger about all the different species of penguins with their sizes, where they live, where you can find them. The practical side of me wants to say, you know, as a mum, I think, well, if she went off to study penguins, like, would there be enough medical help for her if she was to flare? You know, all those things go through my mind. And then I think, actually, I'm not going to stop her following her dreams. You know, why can't she do that? She absolutely can. So, you know, whatever she wants to do, she can do. And I believe that's true of any child with JEA, because for many, many children, the treatments are effective. They can go on to live a very full, very active life, and their JEA does not have to hold them back.
Yeah. Well, and I first of all, if you really were speaking my love language when you were like deconstructing my sentence, because I'm very particular, actually, although on the one hand, I go on long like tangents and sometimes put my foot in the mouth. On the other hand, when I'm writing things down, I'm very, very picky in particular about what words I use and how I structure things, because the meaning of these, the implication of these words is important, right? So what does it mean to you to live a good life, you know, with arthritis, with rheumatic disease? And I feel very stubborn in a positive sense to say, like, you know, let's look at the possibilities to still have a good life. I do think it's interesting, the whole idea of like, I think that my personal opinion was that there are limitations that we have and everyone has them, whether it's, you know, emotional limitations because you've had trauma in your upbringing, or, you know, limitations in your self-esteem, or limitations in your physical body. There surely are some limits that someone would have with, in my, again, this is me being practical, having arthritis. Like, I'm not going to become a massage therapist. Like, my thumbs are not going to tolerate that, you know, but at the same time, I can say there's still so much still available to me. You can channel that love, let's say if what I love about massage is helping people feel better, well, I can channel that in a different way. Or if you love penguins, you can be the person in Antarctica helping the penguins, or in South, you know, Africa, or in, you know, South America, or New Zealand or Australia, or you could be the person that maybe is on the ground communicating, you know, like there's so many possibilities. So being creative and seeing the workarounds is key, instead of trying to force your child into a quote unquote, oh, they have to have an exactly quote unquote normal life like every other kid. It's kind of a farce, because no one, like, who is the person that has that normal life? Do you know what I mean? Like, anyway, we're all comparing ourselves to someone else. And we don't want to artificially suffer because we think we're having something that actually, that we're lacking something that actually nobody has, which is like a normal life, you know? But yeah, normal is overrated. I need t-shirts for that.
We're so on the same wavelength, yeah. Actually, because in my notes I said, you know, I don't compare my life to others because actually that can hold you back and it can lead to disappointment, you know, if you are thinking. So for me, I accepted very early on that I'm not going to become a sports athlete, you know. I kind of accepted that so early on that it never felt like a limitation. So instead of focusing on all the things I can't do, I kind of end up thinking, yeah, but I can do this, I can do that. Like you say, it's other ways of looking at things and seeing, you know, different scenarios and different ways of doing things. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. In a way, I feel like I've become a more flexible person, you know, through having RA. And I mentioned earlier, I'm kind of a control freak, but so by nature, kind of want to control things. It's actually more from my anxiety, because having control gives me the illusion that, or not having control makes me feel anxious. So I grasp onto control, but having a condition that's kind of out of your control in some ways, this forces you to confront, oh yeah, I don't always have control. Look, I'm still here. Like, I didn't die, you know? So you kind of have to like confront your limitations. But yeah, no, so similar. And I think social media has really been like two steps forward, one step back for me with that comparisonitis, because it's like, it's all good in your real life to be like, I have confidence, blah, blah, blah. But on social media, it's like every day you're confronted with all these positive things like support and education and empowerment. And then on the other hand, you're like, if you're not in a good mental place, you're looking like, why is she doing so much better than I'm doing? Or why, you know, you forget that you're just seeing a tiny sliver, you know, someone's life. So I think it's good, like you said, to remind yourself, not just stay in your lane, live your life. You're not living someone else's life, you know? But anyway, sorry. You're a good listener, so I just keep talking. But okay, is there anything else you wanted to share with the listeners before we wrap up?
I think it's just, you know, for parents, I would just say to them, you know, stay hopeful, you know, help raise awareness of the condition, so that, you know, many parents, when their child's diagnosed, they say, I never even knew children can get arthritis. So, you know, just pass that on to others in your own community. So help raise awareness, connect with us at Juvenile Arthritis Research. We always love to hear from, you know, the parents and families that we're connected with. And I think I'd say, don't accept pain for your child, because I think it's hard to know how good things can be when they're in that, when they're first diagnosed and, you know, that child's maybe not able to walk or not able to hold something, you know, whatever it is, whatever joint's affected or whatever it is they can't do. You don't realize what the best situation can be for them. You know, you don't realize how good the medication can be and how effective it can be. So I would just say, please keep going back to your doctors if your child's not getting their kind of life back, as it were. So if they're still struggling and you've given the medication a chance to work and they're still not right and they're still in pain, don't accept that, because that doesn't need to be part of the condition these days. You know, go back to your doctors, because they have got lots more scope for different treatments to try, you know, maybe changing the dose of the treatment. There's lots and lots of things they can do to make sure that child is able to live that good life and to, you know, have a very full, active life. So that's something I've just noticed, that sometimes people kind of accept the pain because they don't realize that that child can be pain-free these days. So yeah, that's kind of my final word of advice. You know, just keep advocating for, you know, parents, advocate for your children, those young adults or people with JA themselves, you know, just understand your condition and advocate for yourself as best you can as well.
And I think that stay hopeful is great for anyone, you know, the parents of kids, but with arthritis and adults with arthritis, it is, you know, we have to hold on to some hope, not necessarily that there's going to be a cure tomorrow, you know, but hope that we will, you know, weather the storms. So where can people find you online?
So our website is www.jarproject.org, and we are on all the major social media channels as well. So you can find us on Instagram, and that's @_jarproject, and Twitter or X as it is, we're just @jarproject, and on Facebook, or Facebook as well. We even have LinkedIn profile and on YouTube as well. So we have a YouTube channel. So you can find us on all those major channels. And if you go to our website, there should be links to all of those to kind of follow from there. So.
Yes. And I'm going to put links to all of the things we've talked about here in the show notes, which are always on my website. You can get to it by going to myarthritislife.net. The long URL is like arthritis.theenthusiasticlife.com, because that's the domain I got a long time ago. Anyway, thank you so much for your time. This was really illuminating. Like, your story is so, or your passion is really inspiring. And I know that there's so many people walking around now who are, you know, living a more hopeful existence because of all your work. So thank you so much again. And hopefully people will connect with you after this episode airs.
Thank you.
Bye for now. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Arthritis Life Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Room to Thrive, an educational program I created from scratch to help you go from overwhelmed to confident, supported, and connected in a matter of weeks. You can go through the pre-recorded course on your own, or you can take the course along with a support group. Learn more at the link in my show notes, or you can always go to www.myarthritislife.net. And if you like this podcast, I would be so honored if you took the time to rate and review it. I also encourage you to share it with anyone you know who might benefit from it. I also wanted to remind you that you can find full transcripts, videos, and detailed show notes with hyperlinks for each episode on my website, www.myarthritislife.net. If you have any ideas for future episodes, or if you want to share your story or wisdom on the podcast, just shoot me an email at info@myarthritislife.net. I can't wait to hear from you.